Hello, this is Wendy Bauer returning with the Decatur Herald and Review, February 8th, 2016. This is the second half hour of our program today. We will continue with the death notices. The deaths listed in Macon County: Robert Dwayne Carlson Sr. of Mount Zion, Alexander Navy, Decatur, James C. Horath, Sr., Decatur, Gerald Clayton Nyheiser, Forsyth, Bonnie C. Pulliam, Forsyth, Robert Shaw, Decatur, Robert E. Sheridan, Decatur, James Rex Vogel of Decatur, and from Central Illinois, Renee Diane Dare of Arthur, Betty J. Gilmore of Tuscola, Margaret A. Hammond of Shelbyville, and Vanita F. Stevens of Cowden. And from the obituaries, Renee Diane Dare from Arthur. Renee Diane Dare, 90, of Arthur, died at 4:08 a.m. Saturday, February 6, 2016, at Carle Hospital in Urbana. Funeral services will be held at 2 p.m. Friday, February 12, 2016, at Schrader Funeral Home, 431 South Vine Street, Arthur. Burial will follow in the Arthur Cemetery. Visitation will be held 1 hour prior to the funeral service. Betty J. Gilmore of Tuscola. Betty J. Gilmore, 87, of rural Tuscola, Illinois, passed away at 3 a.m. Saturday, February 6, 2016, at St. Mary's Hospital, Decatur, Illinois. Funeral services will be held at 12:30 p.m. Tuesday, February 9th, at the Hillegoss Schrader Funeral Home, 705 South Main Street, Tuscola, Illinois. Visitation will be held from 11 a.m. until the service time on Tuesday at the funeral home. Burial will be in the Cartwright Cemetery, rural Tuscola, Illinois. Memorials are suggested to the Parkerville United Methodist Church, Arthur Home, or a charity of the donor's choice. Vonita F. Stevens of Cowden. Vonita F. Stevens, 82, of Cowden, passed away Thursday, February 4, 2016, at St. John's Hospital, Springfield, Illinois. Funeral service will be Tuesday, February 9th, 2016, at 11 a.m. at Lockhart Green Funeral Home in Cowden. Visitation will be Monday, February 8th, 2016, from 5 to 8 p.m. at Lockhart Green Funeral Home in Cowden. Burial will be in Antioch Cemetery, Herrick. Memorials may be made to the family. Robert Dwayne Carlson, Sr. of Mount Zion. Robert Dwayne Carlson, Sr., 80, of Mount Zion, passed away Friday, February 5, 2016, at Heritage Health in Mount Zion. Services to celebrate Bob's life will be at 12 noon Tuesday, February 9, 2016, at Lampstand Presbyterian Church, 655 South Airport Road, Decatur, Illinois. Memorials in Bob's honor are suggested to the Alzheimer's Association. And a listing of the funerals for today, Monday, February 8, 2016, include James C. Horath, Jr., James C. Horath, Sr., 75, of Decatur, 2 p.m. in Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home. Gerald Clayton Jerry Nyheiser, 68, of Forsyth, 10 a.m. in Moran and Goebel Funeral Home. Bonnie C. Pulliam, 63, Forsyth, at 10 a.m. in Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home. Robert E. Sheridan, 91, of Decatur, 10 a.m. in Graceland Cemetery. James Rex Jim Vogel, 63, of Decatur, at 2 p.m. in Moore Funeral Home, Brazil, Indiana. and we will continue with the news from the local page, starting with the page A3 briefs for Monday, February 8th. From Decatur, woman beating. Police say a man pounding on a car with his fists switched to pounding a woman in the face when she got out of the vehicle to confront him early Sunday. Officers dispatched to a parking lot in the 3700 block of North Woodford Street about 2 a.m. found the 39-year-old woman crying and holding her bloodied face. She told them she had been a passenger in the vehicle driven by a friend when the assailant, who apparently had a dispute with the driver, began beating on the hood. She said the suspect hit her in the head 3 times and slammed her with the car door before fleeing. Also from Decatur, phone scam alleged. Police are warning families to be on guard against criminals who try to steal money over the phone by posing as police officers. Written reports filed Saturday say a 64-year-old Decatur woman was ready to pay $500 to settle warrants against her for missing jury duty and contempt of court. Her caller asking for the money claimed falsely to be a member of the Macon County Sheriff's Office. He had wanted $1,000 but agreed to take $500 when the victim said she couldn't afford it. The woman was going to send the money using a prepaid form of debit card, but was stopped just in time by her daughter, who found out what was happening and suspected it was a scam. Police do not make such calls and do not ask for prepaid cards. Those genuinely wanted on outstanding warrants will get a personal visit. From Decatur, old TVs cover lot. A woman contacted by the city and asked to clear a trash-strewn lot near property she owned found it littered with at least 10 televisions, none of them hers, according to Decatur police. The whole or partial TVs were dumped in vacant lot in the 1200 block of North Monroe Street. The 67-year-old property owner said she believes the TVs were left there sometime between January 25th and February 1st. Finally, from Decatur, Snake Turtle Show. Rock Springs Nature Center will have a snake and turtle show from 1 to 2:30 p.m. on Saturday, February 13th. Reptiles will be available to feel and watch as a naturalist describes their lifestyle and helps participants to know these sometimes misunderstood creatures. The fee is $2 per person. Pre-register online by Friday, February 12th at www.maconcountyconservation.org. And now we'll go to the At Work page. From Decatur, Advanced Disposal honors Taylor. Jenny Taylor has been honored as one of the top 10 employees of Advanced Disposal nationwide. Taylor, who works at the company's Decatur location, was named Administrative Clerical Employee of the Year at a ceremony held in Orlando. It is an honor and a privilege to celebrate our best employees each year, said Advanced Disposal Chief Executive Officer Richard Burke. These team members are driven to deliver and are environmental heroes who dedicate their time to clean communities and serving with a service-first, safety-always attitude. Advanced Disposal brings fresh ideas and solutions to the business of a clean environment. As the fifth largest solid waste company in the United States, it provides integrated, non-hazardous solid waste collection, recycling, and disposal services to residential, commercial, industrial, and construction customers. Next, from Decatur, Petrella named Springfield Bureau Chief. Dan Petrella is the new Springfield Bureau Chief for the Herald and Review and Lee Enterprises newspapers. Petrella was previously the Assistant Metro Editor and Projects Coordinator at the State Journal Register in Springfield. Before becoming an editor, he had been the SJR's City Hall and Suburban Reporter. He replaces Kurt Erickson, who is now covering the Missouri Legislature for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. A Lombard native, Petrella has bachelor's and master's degrees in journalism and a bachelor's degree in creative writing from the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. He has also been a reporter for Suburban Life Publications and CUCitizensAccess.org. His freelance work has appeared in Chicago, St. Anthony Messenger, and Louisiana Life magazines, among other publications. He lives in Springfield with his wife, Julia. And we will read portions of the article from the At Work page, titled Meet Julie Shields, Director of the Center for Entrepreneurship at Millikan University. Her hometown. I was born in Springfield, but I've lived in or around Decatur for 16 years, so Decatur-Macon County is now home. And her family. Husband, Zach, who is Executive Director for the Decatur Public Schools Foundation. Daughter, Athena, 15. Twin sons, Hadrian and Caius, 11. And little guy, Noah, 3. Her education. B.A. in Classics, Archaeology, and History, Ancient History specifically, from University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, and an M.B.A. from Millikan University. Her I'd Rather Be bumper sticker would read, I'd rather be daydreaming. It is very satisfying for me to think about new ways of doing things, new products, better ways of working with people, new collaborations, etc. While daydreaming might sound flippant, it is a success strategy, too. I suppose the professional version of that same bumper sticker would be, I'd rather be visualizing, but that sounds pretentious. Hobbies and interests. I am a dabbler, which means I am interested in many different things. Our farm is a great way for me to indulge in experimentation, practice, and play. We have beautiful ponies, productive, read murderous, barn cats, a bouncy puppy, and my favorites, the quirky chickens. Last year, we had a rooster named Rob Lowe. Her first job. Right out of college, I took a part-time job as a recruiter for an IT recruiting company as I was waiting a semester to start law school. I enjoyed it so much, I didn't go to law school and ended up staying in the information technology industry for 13 years or so. Why she does what she does. There are so many reasons. Mostly, it is because I get great joy cheering on individuals who are passionate about achieving their goals, making a difference, owning a business, creating a meaningful life, alleviating pain or challenges, transforming the world, etc. The world needs all these things. I work to help people align their own goals with other like-minded creators, innovators, and entrepreneurs in order to start a movement and make the world a better place. Personal approaches to challenges. I cannot remember who said it, but my philosophy on challenges is, none of us is as smart as all of us. I try to engage others to use our collective wisdom. I try to put a positive spin on challenges and talk openly about how I am trying to solve them. People want to help solve problems, but they do not necessarily want to help if it comes across as complaining. Her community involvement. There are a number of Center for Entrepreneurship-supported community organizations, Micro Business Network, Millikan Decatur Executive Association, SCORE, Youth Leadership Institute program through Partners in Education at Richland Community College, etc. I also sit on the board at Decatur Daycare Center. What is your definition of an entrepreneur? It is someone who can recognize opportunity and lead an endeavor to both create and capture value in the marketplace. Owning a business might be one way to create and capture value, but it can also be created and captured as a social impact venture, what some might call nonprofit, but that is just a tax designation, or within an existing corporation. What is the Center for Entrepreneurship? The Center for Entrepreneurship at Millikan is a unique thing. We have an academic department focused on the discipline and practice of entrepreneurship with our students. We support an entrepreneurship major, minor, 2 undergraduate certificates, and a graduate level certificate. We also have community outreach and youth development components to our mission. In the community, we work with collaborative partners on youth entrepreneurship. and we support small to medium-sized businesses through the Micro Business Network, the Millikan Decatur Executive Association, and SCORE Counseling for Small Businesses. With youth, we have piloted Tech Ventures on campus, held iSmart Girls on campus for a number of years, worked with Decatur Public Schools on Smash Camp Summer Program the past 4 years, co-sponsored the local Maker Fair, and are now working with the Children's Museum of Illinois on its Make Space collaboration. We'll now move to the life pages, beginning with Prairie Talk. This article written by Ed Hungness for the Herald and Review. Thanks, but I'll skip the little candy hearts. Valentine's Day is a time to celebrate love, affection, and friendship. Although not actually a public holiday, it's always celebrated on February 14th. Traced back to early Roman times, historians have varied opinions on its origin, but research indicates it wasn't necessarily a warm and fuzzy affair. Over centuries, the holiday has grown sweeter. Much of the credit for romanticizing the day goes to William Shakespeare and Geoffrey Chaucer, who wrote of it in their works. Their fame, plus the resilience of their stories and poetry, helped spread the popularity of Valentine's Day across England and throughout Europe. During the Middle Ages, people first began gifting handmade paper cards as a display of their affection. Valentine's Day eventually crossed the Atlantic to the New World along with its traditions. Hallmark cards began mass-producing Valentines in 1913, and the holiday hasn't been the same since. Those wanting to express their affection with more than a card frequently give their sweetie a box of chocolates. John Cadbury, who owned a tea and coffee shop in Birmingham, England, had discovered the profitability of chocolate making and in 1822 began packaging their candies in heart-shaped boxes for Valentine's Day. The floral industry and jewelry manufacturers began marketing their products to gift-buying cupids. Even lingerie sellers hopped on board with daring ensembles to make hearts go aflutter. The only thing I ever got in that department was a new pair of wool socks, but they are warm. The holiday is big business with sales in the $18 to $20 billion range, a small price to pay for love, or is it? Most elementary schools observe Valentine's Day with classroom parties. Students sometimes decorate a shoebox or other container, fashioning it into personalized mailboxes, which they craft as a class project or complete at home and bring to school. Valentines can be homemade or store-bought and addressed to their classmates. Typically, their teachers allow each student to deliver their mail to their classmates' mailboxes on the day of the party. Moms bake and decorate Valentine treats such as cookies and cupcakes for the event. I am told, however, that in some parts of the country, Valentine Grinches have thrown the PC wet blanket on the celebration by disallowing homemade treats. Sadly, these children grow up thinking that Valentine's Day consists of gluten-free, peanut-free, sugar-free, prepackaged, and healthy snacks washed down with bottled spring water rather than Kool-Aid. Thank goodness my grade school memories of Valentine's Day parties didn't include celery and carrot sticks dipped in hummus and little tofu sandwiches constructed on rice cakes. My favorite part of Valentine's Day were the little candy hearts with short phrases of one's undying affection for an unsuspecting little classmate with pigtails and a cute smile. Messages such as, "Be mine," "Kiss me," "True love," and "sweetheart" were among the 100 sayings imprinted on little pastel hearts manufactured by Necco. An aspiring young suitor might leave several of these candies on the desk of the object of his secret affection. He would then sit back and watch for a reaction when she discovered them on her desk. I never could let hard candy slowly dissolve. I was too impatient and in a hurry to pop the next one into my mouth. Sadly, the aging process tends to weaken teeth, and a dental crown, though appreciated by my dentist, cost about $1,000. Now I skip the little candy hearts and go straight for the softer chocolate truffles. Happy Valentine's Day, and don't forget your sweetheart. Ed Hungness and his wife became full-time residents of Fife Lake in 2005 after Ed's retirement. He can be reached at edhungness@yahoo.com or by mail at P.O. Box 57, Fife Lake, that's F-I-F-E, Michigan, 49633. And an interview written by Connie Ogle, the Tribune News Service writer. Novelist McDermid turns eye to cyberbullying. Crime writer Val McDermid has never been the victim of cyberbullying, but she's well aware of the effect it has, often on women. I've been lucky. I haven't really been trolled at all, though I do have a public profile here in the UK that goes beyond writing, said the author of 30 novels, who was born and lives in Scotland and has been compared to such crime royalty as P.D. James and Ruth Rendell. My son said it's because I'm too scary. I'm not sure that's what you want your child to say about you. Still, the idea of cyberbullying, think Gamergate, in which anonymous agitators viciously attacked women in the video gaming community, fascinates McDermid, 60. I find it disturbing and fascinating in the way you see a road accident happening in slow motion. In her latest novel, Splinter the Silence, she tackles the subject head-on when psychologist Tony Hill and police detective Carol Jordan, who has just been hired to head up a new task force, team up to track down a possible serial killer who may have taken cyberbullying to a terrifying new level. McDermid juggles two other crime series besides the Hill Jordan books, the Lindsay Gordon and Kate Brannigan series, and also writes standalone thrillers. Splinter the Silence also deals with the subject of alcoholism because McDermid sees the genre as the perfect way to explore serious contemporary topics. We read Charles Dickens to find out what life was like in Victorian England, said the author. In the future, we'll look at the crime novels of today to see what people thought and did. Continuing with the interview, question. Do you know women who have been cyberbullied? Answer. Friends have had horrible experiences. J.K. Rowling had some unspeakable abuse for no reason other than she's been successful, and she speaks out about things she thinks are important. Caroline Criado Perez was trolled mercilessly for daring to suggest Jane Austen be on a banknote. When people say something like this, it's just an expression of opinion. They're not molesting your children or killing your dog or having an affair with your wife. One feels over the last 25 years, attitudes have shifted, and people have made progress in terms of social responses. But all we need is anonymity to be as awful as we always were. Question. When you have an idea for a novel, how do you decide which series to write it for? What makes you decide to write a standalone? Answer. It's the story that comes first with me. I think about what kind of story it is, where it fits, or if it requires a new set of characters to tell that story. Can Tony and Carol investigate, or does it need a different approach? In my standalone novels, protagonists are not conventional investigators, not cops or private investigators or journalists. It's someone with an ordinary life who gets drawn into the investigation for a personal reason. It's a chance to tell other people's stories, how crime affects an ordinary life. I get bored very easily. I'd be so frustrated if I only had one set of characters to work with. I'd have to say goodbye to all these wonderful story ideas that can't be shoehorned in. I have nothing but huge admiration for Sue Grafton, who starts with A and goes on. That's a tremendous commitment. It would drive me slightly mad. Question. What's the biggest challenge of writing a series? Answer. The most difficult thing for me is keeping a sense of authenticity, keeping it credible. Truly, the number of serial killers in Bradfield and the surrounding areas isn't that big, so I need to create the suspension of disbelief. That's my job, really. Everybody knows real murders aren't solved the way they're solved in books, so my first duty is to take readers on a journey of suspension of disbelief to give a sense of authenticity rather than accuracy. A lot of that comes from character and a sense of place driving the story. Question: have you always been a fan of crime fiction? Answer: I think it was imprinted at an early age. Grown-up books had to have dead bodies. I started reading Agatha Christie. I used to spend a lot of time with my grandparents as a kid, and they had one book besides the Holy Bible, Agatha Christie's The Murder at the Vicarage. When I ran out of library books, I'd read Agatha Christie again. I got hooked on the idea of the puzzle, so I sought out the rest of her books. Question: is that why you gravitated toward crime fiction as a writer? Answer: I came out of university, Oxford, with an English degree and an overinflated idea of my abilities as a writer. I was writing the great English novel, but I tried literary fiction and was a dismal failure. I had a fantastic collection of rejection slips. I thought, what I really should do is stick to a genre where I know how it works. What kickstarted me was Sarah Paretsky's Indemnity Only. That really was a light bulb going on in my head. You can write a crime novel with politics and female protagonists. That got me started. Luckily enough, Sarah and Sue Grafton were popular, and British publishers were looking for something similar. Question: you wrote a contemporary version of Northanger Abbey for the Austen Project. Was that intimidating, rewriting Jane Austen? Answer: when they first asked me, I said, don't be ridiculous. Then the more I thought about it, I realized it could be fun, and it would challenge me and stretch me. So with my heart in my mouth, I said yes. Sorting out the practicalities of story and plotting was not that difficult. The thing that took the time was getting the voice right. I didn't want to write a pastiche of Austen. I had to find a different register from how I write crime novels, a different rhythm and voice. That took the most effort. Once I was confident in that voice, it then became fun. It was like going on a holiday almost. It was so different from what I normally do. And a quick review of double headers: top 4 fiction, NYPD Red 4 by Patterson. Number 2, Blue by Danielle Steele. Number 3, My Name is Lucy Barton by Elizabeth Strout. And 4, The Girl on the Train by Paula Hawkins. The top 4 nonfiction bestsellers are When Breath Becomes Air by Paul Kalanithi. Number 2, Spark Joy by Marie Kondo. Number 3, The Name of God is Mercy by Pope Francis. And number 4, Dark Money by Jane Mayer. This has been Wendy Bauer with the Decatur Herald and Review for February 8th, 2016. I look forward to reading with you again soon. Thank you.